Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed, the Boomer and the Babe Show, last show of the week in this second week of February. It's Friday, February 17th, 2012, broadcasting from the studios of the Feeding Arizona Complex in Youngtown. Youngtown, Arizona, that is. Also the home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Anybody looking to make any kind of a charitable donation should please consider the Valley View Community Food Bank here in Arizona. It's a 501c3, and your donations are therefore tax-deductible. Contact them via their website, valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. Jesse Ramirez is the founder and the executive director of the food bank, and he would be more than willing to talk to you and more than willing to accept whatever your donation is, regardless of size and value. They can certainly use the help. I'm Pete Peters, and I want to remind our listeners also that the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated is involved in being on this radio show. We do some publishing of mini books and e-books. Our ebook authors have their own shows here on the Boomer the Babe Network on Blog Talk. We invite you to listen to them as well. We produce videos, promotional products, and consult for small businesses. We are truly a multifaceted, multimedia marketing company. And I'm going to catch my breath. The Babe, Deborah Brown, is not with us today. As I've been saying a lot recently, she is on assignment. That means that she is back at the other office and working diligently on some various projects, some book publishing projects and some website projects and so on and so forth that she has going for us. And we have a special guest today and a special topic, actually. When you talk about boomers, a lot of people don't talk about boomers and the dating world. I mean, it's out there, relationships for boomers and dating, and the way it is nowadays is certainly different than the way it was when we were dating years ago. I know I've been out of the dating scene for well over 20 years, and if I had to go back to the dating scene, I just don't know what I would do, but I would have to ask our guest some topical questions about that, and she is Dr. Terry Orbach. And Dr. Orbach is also known as the Love Doctor. She's been practicing marriage and relationship therapy for more than 20 years herself, and is a popular love advisor on radio, TV, and an outfit called OurTime.com, which is an online dating service for boomers. She's a research professor at the Institute of Social Research, University of Michigan, and a professor at Oakland University. She's author of Five Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage to a... I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Five Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage from Good to Great, and also has a forthcoming book, Finding Love Again, Six Simple Steps to the New and Happy Relationship, to a New and Happy Relationship. I'm going to get those titles right yet, Doctor. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Terry Orbach. How are you today?
I'm good, Pete. Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, believe me, I'm glad to have you as a guest. There are just so many questions, and because I am so out of touch with the dating scene, it's all new to me, I'm sure. And it's going to be interesting talking to you.
I think so, too. I mean, I think the most important thing for us to remember is that relationships are so vital to our health and well-being. So whether we are single and in the dating world, or we're married or in a long-term committed relationship, it's so very important to remember and to focus and to address things that are going on in our relationships.
As an aside to our conversation that we're going to have today, yesterday's show I had a gentleman on by the name of Ken Solon, and Ken has written a book, How to Be a Man. And he has had a group of men for 20 years, and they have discussed and walked through disappointments and heartaches and happinesses and whatever, and how develop, how to develop to be what they determine is a better man. It's not just a case of being a bully and so on and so forth. And you know how that typical that
right.
stereotype is.
Right.
And it was an interesting conversation with him too, because he also got involved in a little bit of what they think that women want. So I'm going to start there. What do you women really want? What does a woman really want?
Well, it's a very good question. I'll give you what I know based on a long-term project that I've been involved with. I've been following the same 373 married couples now for over 24 years.
Wow.
Yes, 46% have gotten divorced, and when they get divorced, I continue to follow these individuals over time. So I like to say now that I'm following 746 individuals, some of whom are still married to one another and some of whom are no longer married to one another. And it's funded by the National Institutes of Health, and really it's to look at what's important to individuals for their relationships. So I think the aim or the focus of the project for the last 24 years really has been exactly the question that you've asked me. What is important for women and what is important for men? I can tell you first that what's important for men is different than what's important for women, but I'm sure you already knew that. You know, I think men and women are similar on many different things, but when it comes to relationships, they're still very different, and they ask different questions.
And they give different answers.
And they give different answers, yes. So let me tell you what's important for women. First, I think women like low conflict or resolving conflict quickly in their relationships. For women, we obsess and we analyze conflict in our relationships, and that's different from how men do conflict. Men do conflict or disagreements or arguments. They do them, they resolve them, and then they forget them, and they go on to the next thing in their life or situation. For us, we do a disagreement, do a conflict, and then we go away and we think about it. And we think about it a little bit more, and then we think about it even a little bit more, and we might come back to our partner or spouse and want to rediscuss or reanalyze or talk about that topic again. But you've forgotten it. And when you say, I don't remember what we're talking about or what we disagreed on yesterday or last week, we're offended because we interpret that to mean that it wasn't important at all. So the first thing is, for women, we need to resolve conflict, and we need to be able to analyze it. Second, should I go on to the second thing?
Yes, but before we do.
I knew you had a comment.
I am sitting here, I am just absolutely rolling with laughter inside and trying to contain myself, because I can think of the times that Deborah and I have had a conflict, and it is so true. I mean, I'll say, oh, it's done, it's forget, you know, it's done. And I have this saying that I said, that horse is glue already. It's glue.
Right.
You know, we passed that thing. You know, it's glue.
And for women, it's not. I should tell you an exercise that I do with the husbands and wives in my study. I have to come in separately and talk about the last conflict they had, the topic, and whether or not it was resolved. The husband will come in, Pete, and talk about how it's difficult to remember the last time that they had a conflict or disagreement, but maybe it was last week and it was about, oh, I don't know, he'll say, the dogs, who should walk the dogs, and definitely it was resolved. The husband will go out of the room, the wife will come in, and she will literally say, yesterday at 2 p.m., he said this, she said that, I was wearing this, and it wasn't resolved. So it's such a different experience for men and women, conflict, disagreement, and like you said, having it be over or still analyzing it.
Well, he resolved the conflict because he took the dog for a walk. It was over. It was done. The dog did his duty. He picked it up on the sidewalk, threw it away, and it was over.
Exactly.
And he knew that it was over because task accomplished. You know, and she got her way. What more is there in the world other than, you know, keep her off my back? How's that sound? I mean, is that a typical male way of looking at things?
Absolutely. I think the male way of dealing with problems, whether they be in or out of a relationship, is to fix it, solve it, and move on. And I think that's so different for women, which is really the second difference or what we want. We like empathy. We like to be listened to. We like face-to-face interaction, and we like to talk and talk about feelings. So when we have a problem and we go to you and we say, husband, partner, you know, I had a problem at work today and I don't know how to resolve it, or I want to talk to you about it. We want you to just listen and empathize and shake your head and say to us, oh, that sounds so difficult. It must have been hard. Instead, what you want to do is solve it. You want to give me advice and what we call instrumental support. You want to give me ways to resolve it or fix it, and I just want you to sit there and shake your head. So I think that's another big difference between men and women in terms of relationships.
What happens when the woman says, the man starts to say, well, this is what I think you should do, this is what I think you should do, and the woman says, well, I don't necessarily agree with that, or I'm not done talking yet, or I'm not done telling the story yet, or whatever the case might be, and the man says, just do what I say, and it'll go away, you know, just do it.
Right. You want us to abide or do what you say we should do. But I wish it would get to that point, Pete. I think what happens is that as soon as the male offers advice, wants to fix it or resolve it, she gets very upset. And I should say that when husbands come to a female partner or a wife, he wants to be able to fix it. And fix it quickly. But she's going to be giving the what we call emotional support back to him. She's going to be shaking her head and say, wow, that sounds really hard, sweetie. It must have been difficult at work. He also is going to respond negatively, because what happens is everyone has expectations about how something should happen or should go. And when reality doesn't match our expectations or our should statements, we become very frustrated, disappointed, and angry. So I think it can go both ways. Men get just as frustrated as women when it doesn't go how they want it to go or think it should go.
I was intrigued when you were saying that the woman will go away, ruminate over it, contemplate it, come back, bring it up again. And it may be the case, I believe, that it may not be brought up again in a day or two or three. It might be 3 months from now when there is another issue that has to be handled.
Yes.
And she will, the woman, will reach into what has been called by some, I don't know if this is what you term it or not, the brown paper bag.
I call it the kitchen sink.
Okay. Well, I've heard it called the brown paper bag.
Yes.
You reach in and you grab one of these things that are standing in there and you throw it and say, and then there's this. And then, here's another one. And then there's this. And, oh, and don't forget this one. Bingo. And the guy sitting there goes, where the devil did all this stuff come from?
Yes.
And he's blindsided and baffled because that was done 6 months ago.
Absolutely. And in a box.
The woman doesn't forget, and she remembers every darn word.
And there are, I think, advantages and disadvantages to that, Pete. I think the disadvantage is what you're saying, that it boxes you in, and you don't know where to go. You don't know whether you should start with the first thing that she mentioned or the thing that she mentioned 6 months ago happened and annoyed her. And so it really doesn't go anywhere, that kind of discussion, or what I call kitchen sinking, bringing everything into the conversation at once, or, as you suggested, reaching into the brown bag and bringing up these different issues. And I think for women, it's very important to stick and be specific about one behavior that annoys you or one issue at a time. Now, the advantage to that, Pete, is that as women, we have wonderful, amazing, great, what I call relationship memories. We can remember who said what and who likes whom and what happened last time. And we can tell stories about our relationship as well, from the beginning to the middle to the present. And so I think that there are advantages and disadvantages for women to have such specific relationship memories.
Well, the thing that I enjoy is when Deborah will say to me, well, there's this, and there's this, and there's this. And we're not talking about major stuff here. It's just the things, you know, that you accumulate as a couple. And I say, well, you know what, sweetie? If nothing else, I'm at least consistent. I haven't changed. I'm still doing the same things that annoy you then. I'm still doing them now. Isn't that good for consistency?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That doesn't get
me anywhere either, by the way.
Right, exactly. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Pete, because one of the most surprising things that I have found in my long-term study on marriage and divorce is that happy couples do what I call sweat the small stuff. And I think that's opposite to what we've been hearing in the media. What we hear in the media is that if you want to be happy, you don't sweat the small stuff. But what I found is that when it comes to your relationships, it's actually very important to address the small things, to mention, to talk about the small things that are annoying you or not going so well, because otherwise they accumulate over time. And what starts out as a small issue, like he throws his socks on the floor or she talks with her food in her mouth or whatever the seemingly small, almost insignificant thing at the beginning, if they're not addressed, they accumulate, they build up, and they become bigger issues. And these bigger issues of he doesn't respect me, she doesn't care for me or notice me, or she takes me for granted, are really much more difficult to unpack and really much more bigger issues for the happiness and the stability of a couple over time. So I encourage people to actually talk about those little things, those small annoying things over time.
Yeah, because they can indeed grow to become large things. There's no doubt about it. There are different, obviously, different ages and groups of people along the way. I mean, there's the millennials, and there's the baby boomers, and there's the super seniors, and whatever. Do each of those segmented age groups or generational groups have specific things that they have to be concerned about or are concerned about in a dating relationship?
I think that there are some very common challenges that, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80s-year-old individuals who are single and out in the dating world experience. For example, first and foremost, I think these individuals who are single don't have the opportunities and places to meet available others. It's not like you were or it was when you were in college, when everyone around you is single and available. So I think it's very different. You really have to really take control and responsibility over the situation yourself and gain information about where you can have these opportunities and places to meet available others. We know, studies show, my own included, that there are three common ways for boomers and seniors and both of those groups to find available others. First is what I call group activities. So an activity that meets regularly that an individual joins. It can be a religious group, it can be an athletic group, a card playing group, a book club, a wine appreciation club, a gym class. But if you meet regularly and then you go to that group activity, it's what we call the mere exposure effect. Mere exposure or contact with someone, you don't even have to talk to them, increases liking both ways. So if I see you, I go to a gym class or a yoga class every week, the mere fact that I am seeing you increases positivity, I feel more comfortable toward you, and then I'm much more likely to talk to you, meet you, and start dating you. So that's a really common way. Second is online dating. And third is actually blind dates or being fixed up. And yes, they are effective, they are successful, and it is not just for the desperate.
The blind dating.
Yes, blind dating.
Yeah.
So that's the first challenge. The second challenge is that many boomers and seniors have experienced either a divorce or the loss of a spouse. And I think those two groups have unique experiences and challenges. If you've experienced a divorce, it's difficult to move on sometimes for many boomers and seniors. You have negative feelings, you may have anger, and so it's very important to deal with those feelings first as you get on into the dating world. And if you've experienced the loss of a loved one, oftentimes there are mixed feelings about dating again. You feel as if you have to give up the positive feelings that you have or have had toward your spouse and your marriage. And so I think those are unique challenges. And then finally, many boomers and seniors have to deal with their adult children. And this can be challenging because oftentimes they want to please or make sure that their children, adult children, are okay, and rightly so, and their feelings come last. And so it's a challenge to sort of navigate both the feelings of your adult children and your own, as well as new partners, and what to do with all those situations. So I think those are unique challenges that don't necessarily occur in the dating world for people in their 20s and 30s.
I would think, and here again, this is just a supposition on my part because I'm not experienced either one or any of those, but I would suggest that a person that has had a good relationship, a good marriage, whatever it might be, long term, more than a couple of years, but a deeply held relationship, and all of a sudden there is a loss by death, that could be absolutely one of the most devastating things that could be put in front of you as far as moving on is concerned in the dating scene. And that just comes to my mind that might be one of the worst things.
Actually, when we look at studies, though, Pete, I think divorce as well as the loss of a spouse are both devastating experiences. Shake your world, are extremely stressful, and take a lot of coping and adjustment and resilience on the part of the individual. Each of them have unique situations. In the situation that you just described, where someone experiences the loss of a loved one, many times you can say to yourself, I had such a positive experience. I had such a positive relationship. I have a model. I have someone and a process and a way that has shaped me. I want to find that wonderful situation again. And it may never be the case that I will find that exact most positive situation, but at least I've had it. And at least I know what love is, and I know what trust is. And so there is the ability to do that. Obviously not a way, obviously in a time period that the individual feels most comfortable with. if at all. In the situation of a divorced individual, that always isn't the case. Many individuals, when they experience a very conflictive, angry situation in the situation or experience of a divorce, don't feel like they have a model, don't feel like they've had the positive experience of trust and love that's been able to afford them to say that they have the ability or strength or trust in others. And so I think both are devastating experiences, Pete, with unique challenges, some common and some unique.
Do you think there are myths that surround the baby boomers? Of course, the baby boomers being born between 46 and 64, that's a pretty wide age group as far as our cohort is concerned. But are there some common myths that surround dating and baby boomers?
Yes, I think there are some common myths. First, what I find when I talk to baby boomers is that there's a myth that there's a definite period of time after a divorce or the loss of a loved one before you're ready psychologically to get out there and date again. And if we look at this statement, there is absolutely no scientific evidence to support it. So there is no research study, no finding that says you have to wait X amount of time or that you have to be, you know, ready for this amount of time period before you can form another attachment or an emotional commitment. I think what we have to stress is that for baby boomers, you want to ask yourself when you're ready. When are you ready to trust again, and when are you ready to love again? For some people, for example, who have experienced a divorce, they have been emotionally separated from that person for years. And so the physical separation or the legal divorce that occurs, they've been ready way before that. So I think that's one of the myths. The second myth that I find is that men are more hesitant about making a commitment after divorce or loss of a loved one than women. And that, again, is totally a myth. It turns out that women are more selective and cautious about who they love and making a commitment. Men actually fall faster and fall harder than women. Does that sound like something you would agree with or not?
Men fall faster and harder,
yes,
than women. It didn't happen to me that way, but then again, I wasn't a baby boomer when it happened either. So, maybe. I think men might work harder at it. By that I mean they have more. They look harder. They work harder at it. In other words, well, let's see what this lady's all about. Let's see what's going on with this one. And I'll go to this bar because I heard it's a hot place. I think maybe in that respect, they work harder. Do they actually fall faster? I don't know that I can agree with that necessarily, because I know for myself right now, as I exist at my age, if something, God forbid, were to happen to Deborah and she weren't with me anymore, I'd don't think I would go trying to replace that anytime soon. I mean, I would be very social, whatever, but I don't think I would. I guess you can't control it, so you don't know until you've been through it, but right. I would not anticipate that for myself, and I don't know that I'm that different from most. Could be wrong. Don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at research, just research, Pete, not you, if we look at research, women are more selective and cautious about who they love. It's a longer period of time before they find a long-term partner again, and men find a long-term partner faster, sooner, and are more likely to do that after the experience of a divorce or the loss of a loved one. So it's just interesting, You know, again, you're right. We never know for our own self what would happen.
Let me ask
I'll
you
tell you another myth, too.
Sure, go ahead. Let me ask you one more question about that, what you just said first. Is it because a man is more willing to settle for whatever and than the woman is willing to settle? The woman is looking for something more, something deeper, whatever the case might be, the man is willing to settle.
Well, I think part of that is right. I agree with you that women want to be absolute dead sure about a partner in a relationship before they commit or are in love. So I think part of that is absolutely true. The other thing, though, Pete, which is interesting, is that women just have more relationships in their life, and they get more affirmation from many other people in their lives. So when a woman is asked to write down the five closest people to her, she can write down five, but she really wants to write down 10 or 15, and all of them are extremely important, and they affirm her and validate her. And even when she walks into a coffee shop or to get her hair done, she gets affirmation from those people about her and herself. Men, on the other hand, have fewer people in their close circle. So when they write down five people, it's harder for them. And again, I'm just talking on average. It's not every single male. It's not every single woman. But they have a more difficult time writing down those five close people. They're more likely to say the closest person to them is their partner. And then after that, the people are less close in their outer circle. But they get affirmation, they crave that affirmation from that partner. And when they don't get it, because that person is no longer in their life, let's say, they need another close other to get that affirmation, because rarely do we hear men hanging out with one another saying, you know, oh, I love your ideas, your tie is great, you know, you're a wonderful person, you rock my world. Or when they walk into the coffee shop, someone always saying to them, you're great, you're wonderful. So men need it, crave it from that one significant other.
That's a very interesting point, and what really is interesting is I've had two guests on back-to-back days that have said the same thing about men. when Ken Solon, because, I mean, that's been his study for 20 years with the same group of men for 20 years, he has said that men don't have close friends.
Right.
And men don't have that kind of women have women's groups, women have organizations, women have whatever they do for their positive feedback, their positive affirmation, their, willingness to be accepted, whatever you want to term it. Men don't have it. You know, so chances are, if you ask a man who are your best, closest male friends, they may not be able to name any of them. And when he says best, closest male friends, that is somebody that he kind of defined yesterday as who would you call if your back was to the wall and you needed help, and you needed help right now, who would you call?
Absolutely.
Way he was describing it.
And I will tell you that, you know, women have sisters and neighbors and moms and even kids that give them affirmation. And in my long-term study on marriage and divorce, now working with these same and interviewing these same couples over 24 years, I can definitely state that if men do not feel affirmed by their wives often, that couple is almost two times more likely to get divorced over time. It is not the same situation when women report that they don't feel affirmed by their husbands often. So it is so essential when husbands do get it, because if they don't, they feel distressed, they feel unhappy, and over time, that relationship erodes. So it is not only important in the situation, but it's important to happiness and stability of a relationship.
Well, it's interesting. I have two people now that I've spoken to back to back, and from completely different backgrounds, and the hypothesis is the same.
And I should say, Pete, I agree, because it's so significant from, you know, both Ken and myself, that it for your listeners who are in a relationship, it doesn't take much for males either. What I have found is that all it takes is consistent affirmation, words or one phrase every day. And I write about this in my book, 5 Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage from Good to Great, that all you have to say is, I love you, you're wonderful, I've noticed that you are doing more around the house, or I noticed something about you, or let's plan to do something together. So that all it really is saying, I notice you, I value you, and it's just one phrase a day. Or you can do one action a day. So you can make, you know, his favorite dessert. You can, you know, turn on the coffee pot in the morning because you know he needs his caffeine when he gets up in the morning. That it's these simple phrases or simple gestures that equals affirmation and validation. So we're not talking about constant, I love you, you're great, you're wonderful. Just once a day.
Interesting. Very interesting. It doesn't take much. You're right. I'm wondering also about a little bit that we wanted to get into this online dating, because after all, you do work for Our Time and you're affiliated with ourtime.com, which is a dating site for boomers. And I don't understand. Here again, this goes to shows to go you, as they say, that I haven't been doing this any dating for since forever. But my daughter and her current husband, her only husband to date, and hopefully it stays that way, met via a dating site kind of a situation. I think it was through one of the radio stations in San Diego when we lived there. And it was like, what are you doing, you know? And she found this gem, and he found his gem, and it was amazing, because Deborah and I went to dinner with them on their first date inadvertently. I mean, it wasn't something that we planned to do. It just came up because she was working, going to school, and she was working as a waitress, and they were opening a new restaurant, and she was asked to bring herself and friends, some friends or family, and be patrons at the restaurant so they could train the staff. So what she did, and she had been, they had been trying to get together, and he'd have a hearing, or he was a lawyer, he's a lawyer, and he'd have to do this or have to do that, and they couldn't. So finally, she said, this is what's happening on this particular day. I'm going to be there. My parents are going to be there. Would you like to join us? And he said, yes. And he walked in. So we were on their first date.
Wow.
And I figured this guy's got to have something going for him if he's willing to go out and have the first date with this girl that he's never met before in his life personally, and doesn't mind that her parents are there. So I figured, well, you know, this is probably an all right guy. Turns out he's also a University of Michigan Law School graduate.
Well, that's
so I thought I'd throw that one in there for your benefit.
Thank you.
Go blue. But I don't know that I could get back into that scene. I would have to look for another way to do it. And I prefaced this long story, this question, by indicating that that's the only background I have with online dating, is I see what happened to my daughter, and I can't say that it's bad. Do boomers have a propensity to stay away from online dating? Are they fearful? How does it interact with a lot of these things that we've been talking about?
Well, first, I loved your story about your daughter and you being on their first date. That's wonderful. But it also, you know, says, Pete, that, you know, people are busy these days, and boomers especially. You know, you've got kids, grandkids, work, exercising, volunteering in the community, wanting to get outside. I mean, we're all so busy. And I think that is why online dating is so great for everyone, but especially people, you know, as boomers, 50 plus. And that's why ourtime.com is the largest online dating community catering to singles over 50, because they recognize that there may be challenges, there may be concerns, there may be benefits unique to this group of individuals. So let me tell you what I think are the great benefits, because we know that online dating is successful and it is safe. So first, I think it's so convenient and you have all of the control, and that's what many boomers want. We want, or boomers want, the control. And so you can do the online dating and meet people in the comfort of your own home at any hour of the day or night. So you can do it at 2 a.m. in the morning or 2 p.m. in the afternoon. You can do it in your pajamas. You can do it with a friend with you who can help you do it, help you write the profile, help you respond. You can, you know, write out your message and then look at it and edit it and then write it again. And so I think that is wonderful, because it really is convenient and you call the shots. Second, I think many boomers have, as you suggested, a little anxiety, not sure about making the first move. It's been a long time. And I think online dating, unlike face-to-face interactions or going out on a date for the first time or, you know, being fixed up, allows you to sort of get your feet wet slowly. You can, you know, chat with someone once, and then you can wait, and then you can do it again. And so you have the ability to call your shots and do as much as you want, rather than if you're sitting next to somebody having coffee with them, it's coming out of your mouth, and you might be showing your anxiety, you might be sweating, all of those kinds of things. Third, I think it really, especially with ourtime.com, which has over 1 million members and over 10,000 new members every single day, you can really expand your pool of potential matches. So it's not like you just have your friends and, or, you know, the community center and whomever goes there. This opens up a huge door and options and really increases your chances of meeting someone who's truly right for you. And then I think finally, the unique great benefit is that, you know, the back and forth of online conversation helps you figure out if someone really does have the qualities you seek, you want, and are important to you before meeting them in person. And so you don't have to meet the person until you know that they have the qualities for you.
Seeing as how baby boomers are a cross-section of the population, and you're going to find good and bad in any group, 78 million of us baby boomers indicates that we're going to have our share of ne'er-do-wells, our share of people that have ulterior motives, however you want to term it, say it nicely or not so nicely. How can somebody, male or female, that is talking to somebody via the online service, any online service, be safeguarded and be relatively assured that the person they're talking to really is what they say they are? Is there anything that's built into this system that allows for that?
Well, first I should say, yes, the answer is yes. But first I should say that online dating is no safer or less safe than meeting in any other way, and success is much more common than having a bad experience online. That being said, I think there are many things that an individual can do, him or herself. First, You know, you never want to give any money out to anybody you meet online. You shouldn't do that on the phone. You shouldn't do that online. And you always want to be guarded in terms of your own personal information. So I encourage people not to give out their full names at the beginning, not where they live. If you do end up giving a phone number, give out a cell phone number. And so you want to make sure that you take those precautions. Also, listen to your gut. I think if something doesn't sound right or you have, you know, an instinct that, you know, this might be a signal, listen to that. If someone's never available, someone wants to know way too much about you, someone is professing their love after one email or one chatting situation, listen to your gut. Go with your gut. Believe in yourself. Also, take your time. You know, what we know is that intimacy develops much sooner online because we don't have the distractions of seeing that person. So take your time. There's no reason why you have to go fast or quickly. If you do ever meet in person, you always want to meet in a public spot. You want to drive yourself to and from these first few meetings. You want to tell a friend. You want to do your homework. And you definitely want, again, to also listen to your instincts when you meet that person. Now, every online dating site has people who are a part of, you know, their site. For example, ourtime.com has a group of people, so if you ever have a concern, you can email them and let them know. They have a huge group of people that work regarding fraud and scam awareness. They really take safety seriously, and in fact, they have many articles on that site, as do other sites, really geared toward giving tips about safety, giving tips about how to write a profile, upload pictures, how many pictures, all kinds of things that if you do join a site will help the members.
When it just occurred to me as you're saying that, we do have a friend that has met the person that she's dating now via an online site, and I unfortunately don't know which one it was, but I do recall that when she finally gave it up, so to speak, that she was indeed going to meet this person that we didn't even know was happening, and she was a very good friend of ours, Deborah in particular.
Mm-hmm.
She gave up the information that she was going to go meet this person, and we were all just—I mean, the whole group, such as it is—we're just saying, "Oh my God, you know, no, you know, where are you going to be? What, you know, the whole nine yards." Well, I've already taken care of. I feel comfortable. I go. And we were going, oh my goodness gracious! You know, she's gonna go off to a different state to meet this person. Why doesn't she come down here and have the police standing out in front of the house?
Right.
But they,
well, and I think you know, if
together.
She would have what?
And they're still together. They're still dating on a regular basis now.
Yeah, and, you know, success really is very common. 1 in 5 new relationships and 1 in 6 new marriages are the result of people meeting on an online dating site. But I do think that precaution is important and that everyone needs to take safety precautions so that you should not go to this person's home. They should not come to your home. You should meet in a, like I said, a very neutral public spot. You should do that for several times before you ever let them see where you really live. I even encourage people, as I suggested previously, to tell a friend to call you, to tell them first who you're meeting, where and when, and then call you in the middle of the date. You have a keyword or a signal so that if there's any concern, that person knows exactly where to go and how to pick you up. Or that it's a way to get out of a first date by having your friend call if you need to. And so telling people that it's happening, where it's happening, and having these safety precautions built in are great. Also, to remember that staying sober or not drinking too much on that first date if you're meeting someone online is also an important thing, because when we alcohol's involved, it tends to impair our judgment, and so that's a factor. And also, as I mentioned, remember that, you know, short and sweet is what's important. 2 hours, go to a restaurant, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and if you like each other, then you'll set another date.
It doesn't necessarily have to continue on the wee hours of the morning, because you're
no
being open end leaves ended also leaves possible other ramifications to jump in there and complicate issues.
Absolutely.
What are some helpful hints, I guess is the right way to say it, for making the best impression on a first date, whether it's online or in person?
Well, I think first is that you want to plan ahead for your first date. You know, take some time to think about what you'll do and say, and I think that's totally okay. I even encourage people to write down some questions as they think about the first date. And some people say, oh, then it's not spontaneous or that's too much. But it just gives you some organization, and planning ahead is always great. I think focusing on dressing up or making your best first impression is also good. You're not hiding your true nature, just putting your best face forward. And if that means dressing up a little bit, I think that's great. Asking questions. I think the biggest mistake that people make, Pete, is that they think they have to sell themselves on this first date. So they do all the talking on this first date, and they talk about themselves and who they are and what they like to do. Instead, remember that the first date is a give and take, and it is just as important, almost more important, to ask questions to this other person, not just to talk about yourself. Next, remember that you don't want to disclose everything all at once. I think the other big mistake that people make is that they say, especially boomers, you know, I'm going to put it all on the line here, and if this person doesn't like me, then too bad. And I understand that perspective, but what you want to remember is it's almost like what we call the airplane phenomenon. You sit down next to someone, and if you talk too much and you tell everything about yourself to this person, it's overwhelming. They want to leave. So gradually self-disclose about yourself over several dates. Don't say everything all at once. And finally, remember that sense of humor is wonderful. Women love to smile and laugh, and a good sense of humor.
The institution of dating, I guess I can call it that, is certainly changed over the years, hasn't it? I mean, it's almost, maybe I'm just seeing it wrong because I haven't been doing it. Sometimes I get a feeling that it's almost anything goes. What do you find as far as that's concerned?
I actually think that relationships and the dating scene is faster, meaning relationships develop quicker. But I don't get the feeling that anything goes. I think what we hear in the media is more oriented toward the younger college student, and that's what we hear about all dating. But when it comes to boomers or baby boomers, there's still the sense that I want to find a companion. I want to find someone who's right for me. I want someone who's similar in underlying values and attitudes. And I'm not going to, quote, settle. I'm going to find someone who can enjoy life with me. And so I don't get the feeling that anything goes. Is it a different situation than when it was, when baby boomers were 20 or in their 20s or teens? Yes, absolutely. Things happen faster, and technology is such a bigger influence and a bigger part of the dating scene than it ever was. Not only are people meeting online these days, but texting and cell phones and video cams and Skyping are becoming much more a part of our relationship and the dating process than it ever was before.
Well, then how does a person know when a relationship is right, or if it's right for them?
Well, it's a very good question. I think there are two questions you want to ask yourself. First is about similarity. Do you have underlying similar values and attitudes as this person? So I'm not talking about interests or hobbies or even food preferences, but I'm talking about those values, about the importance of religion or children or the approach to money. If you're similar, you're much more likely to stay together over the long haul. Second, how do you do conflict? If you do have a disagreement, do you resolve the conflict well? You're going to have conflict in a relationship. It's how you deal with it. That's so very important over the long haul. And then the last thing, or the last question that I think is important, Pete, is do you trust this person? And trust is so essential. Does this person have your best interests at heart? And do they, you know, really care about you, and they wouldn't hurt or deceive you? And I think those are the three really important questions to ask yourself to determine whether or not this relationship is right for you.
Well, see, that's one thing that I appreciate about my relationship with Deborah, is that she has my back. I mean, mm-hmm. I know she's got my back, and I have hers.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's a common watching out for one another. Physically, emotionally, whatever, but it's, yeah, we have each other's back, and that's a nice feeling. It really is a nice feeling to know, and anybody that can find that kind of an arrangement is really bucks up in my mind. They're ahead of the game as far as a relationship is concerned.
And actually,
I don't think it's that common anymore.
Well, when I ask the couples in my long-term study on marriage and divorce what the number one important thing in their relationship is, the majority say that my partner would never hurt or deceive me, and I can count on this person in good times to celebrate the goods as well as to help me with the trouble or the bad times. So at least when they're asked, that's the most important thing for people in their relationships.
Well, we're getting down to the short rows here. As much as I hate to say that, I could continue this conversation with you from now until the cows come home, as they say.
Thank you.
why don't you give us a little information about how people can reach you, get hold of your books, tell us a little bit about the books the book you've written and the one that's coming soon, I guess. This is your chance for a good old-fashioned Dr. Terry Orbach commercial.
Oh, thanks, Pete. Well, my website is Dr. Terry, theLoveDoctor.com. And so it's D-R-T-E-R-R-I, theLoveDoctor.com. If you just Google The Love Doctor, you will find me. My book, Five Simple Steps to Take Your Marriage from Good to Great, is in bookstores and online and on Kindle. It's a wonderful book for people who are okay or good or even great, and they want to take their relationship to the next level. Make it exceptional. It is readable, and it's all about easy, simple steps to make your relationship great. My second book, Finding Love Again, Six Simple Steps to a New and Happy Relationship, will be out in June 2012. It is already on Amazon.com, and so you can pre-order the book, but it will be coming out in June, and it's all about letting go of the past and becoming emotionally and cognitively or belief ready to form a new relationship. How to do that? And then how to find that someone special.
All good information, and I hope people take advantage of the fact that they can get some of your wisdom via these books and website and so on. One last question for you before we go. Let's assume that everybody that we're talking to is in a very happy and long-term relationship. How do you maintain it?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is to focus on the positive instead of trying to fix the negatives or the problems. I think most of us are going toward those negatives, but instead get out a piece of paper, write down the 5 positive qualities in your partner or relationship, keep them close to you, and focus on those positive, because that positive energy, that optimism, is not only attractive to your partner, but it encourages you to move forward, that energy. And so focus on the positive rather than the negative.
I think those are pretty doggone good words to end this program with, Terry. I appreciate the fact that you've taken the time out of your day. I'll be getting in touch with you here shortly, and we'll discuss how you can use this program for your own purposes as well. And thanks again for spending the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Pete. It's been wonderful.
Been a joy. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you a great conversation with Dr. Terry Orbach, the Love Doctor. We'll bring you more information next week and more great conversation Monday through Friday on our regular program shows, as well as some of our ebook authors that have their shows next week as well. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe every Monday through Friday from 10 o'clock right here at 10 o'clock Arizona time. Right here on Blog Talk Radio. That's 12 Eastern and 9 Pacific. Remember, we do much more than host this show on Blog Talk. Check us out at boomerandthebabe.com. Please sign up for our online magazine, Boomer Experience Speaks, absolutely free. It's a monthly online magazine. It'll come directly to your inbox. And everything that we do hopefully makes it easier and more enjoyable for you to do what you do, and make sure that the second half of your life is the best half of your life. And have a great weekend, everybody, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care now. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as PetePeters47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.